forward with a pilot on painting roofs white.
Yay!
And they have been taking the steps to be able to address some of those challenges and make sure that there aren't any problems legally or with warranty. But it's a slow process sometimes. And when you have something like extreme heat waves, you need to also have ways to respond immediately.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, definitely makes sense that there are some barriers to getting things done quickly and efficiently. And it's great that there's been so many innovative solutions that I've actually never heard of to combat this. And I was wondering, like, what are the strengths of collaboration between an academic institution like a university with community members and community organizations?
I have to kind of frame this by saying, like, in order to allow the strengths to present themselves, you need to kind of create a playing field where all knowledge and expertise is valued. You can't kind of create a space where it's like, oh, we're going to bring in researchers and they're the ones with like the actual expertise and the theory, and then community members can like respond to that. Mm-hmm. That is not at all what we are seeking to do. We want to really, I think what really makes the CLEAR project successful is we try and really avoid that hierarchical approach of like what knowledge is valued and that academic research or peer-reviewed knowledge is the actual solutions, and the community can kind of match up with that and make it work, right? We want to create a space where lived and living experience, where indigenous forms of knowledge, community-generated experience, community-generated reports and knowledge, just because it hasn't, you know, passed through peer review or because it's not published on an academic journal does not mean that some of the reports or zines or the artifacts generated in the community are not these deeply resourceful and impactful tools that are already trying to address some of these things as well. And so I think the thing that we've really tried to embody, and I kind of talked about not adding to the research landscape, just kind of making existing research accessible to the community. And by holding these community forums, we're inviting politicians, researchers, community organizers, community members. Again, it should not feel like an academic lecture that the university is there to fix things or tell the community how things should be done. We want to be responsive to, again, what is already going on in the community. What are the assets? What are the strengths? What organizations are already doing this work that if we empower them, if we use the research or the funding that the university has to really empower the work that's already going on, that's the way that we're going to be successful. And so I think really emphasizing the importance that these community organizations, the knowledge they hold, the networks that they have, and the people power that they've already had working on these issues for many, many years, not creating a landscape where that's devalued, and really creating spaces of conversation and spaces of action where we're really relying on what networks and skills that these community partners have. I really think about there's a project we have right now that's working on the procurement of cooling supplies. The cooling kits I was talking about, unfortunately, did not have the same funding this year as they've had in previous years. And so a lot of organizations were left scrambling a little bit to kind of collect some cooling supplies to best support the needs of their residents or their patrons. There's a wonderful network, and I'm going to give SFU a little bit of props here. We're on the SFU turf. So there's some wonderful folks who work out of SFU's Siri office, which is located at 312 Main in the downtown Eastside communities. That's a community engaged research office, and we need more of those, pretty please. If anybody from other universities are listening, the more community engagement spaces in community, the better. They published something quite recently called the Climate Resilience Roadmap for Nonprofits in the Downtown Eastside, and this is a very tangible, action-focused document that really takes ideas of what does climate justice look like, specific, tailored to the Downtown Eastside, and how can we take tangible action from that instead of just never-ending discussion loops. And so we've been working with folks over there to do different projects. That's kind of where some of the exploration around knitting canopies has gone on. But this summer especially, they kind of merged their team of partners, which include First United. I mentioned Amanda Burrows. It includes the Portland Hotel Society. It includes Hogan's Alley. For those unfamiliar with Hogan's Alley and the Hogan's Alley Society, it was a historic black neighborhood located quite close to where the Learning Exchange exists that was destroyed to build the Georgia Viaduct. But there's a wonderful group called the Hogan's Alley Society that is dedicated to both preserving the history, empowering the new generation of Black Vancouverites living in and around that area, but they're also taking climate justice very, very close to heart through their work as well. And so this big network of partners working with us at UBC, working with the SFU project, they all kind of like the Avengers. We kind of came together and combined our powers, and they created this like massive procurement network this summer that really looked at, okay, Portland Hotel Society already has this procurement channel. Working Gear is already working with this company that can get us sunscreen and get us water bottles? What if we put together all of our resources, all of our power, all of our spending power, and we were able to kind of maximize the cooling supplies we can get and distribute them all the different organizations? And it looked different for every organization. One was doing pure lead misting stations where they just had community members spraying each other like with like big misting, cooling each other down on hot days. One was actually handing out cooling supplies. But again, it was peers working with that organization who were doing it, not UBC staff members, not SFU faculty. It was the community organizations kind of pooling their resources with the support of UBC and SFU, but really addressing a need, an emergent need around getting these cooling supplies together. And again, we really relied on their networks, the access to cooling supplies that they knew that they could have. We helped with the coordination, but it was really like everybody coming contributing what they could, their own experiences, their own expertise, and their own networks to really address something that kind of unfortunately came, I won't say it came out of nowhere, but we were very disappointed to find out that the cooling kits were not going to be funded. We said, what can we, again, we're not going to wallow in this. What action can we take? Let's work with this wonderful team of folks from SFU, from UBC, and from all these organizations to make it happen. And it really came together in a good way this summer. And so that's really what it looks like, is relying on everybody's expertise and what knowledge they're bringing to the table, never assuming that you know more about a certain topic than they do, or that, you know, academic is greater than. It's cheesy. It's why the learning exchange is called the learning exchange. We want to fight against hierarchical or colonial ideas of what knowledge is valued and how knowledge is owned or shared. And I think the Clearer Project is a great example of how we kind of embody that.
Yeah, totally. And talking about accessibility in research, I want to get into as well. I personally study psychology at SFU, and the further into academia and research that I get, the more I realize the amount of just straight up jargon, but also like the barriers to access can greatly impede the potential benefits of research. Like when the methodology is designed by the researchers and isn't in line with the community's needs, we end up with solutions that don't actually solve anything or aren't even acted upon, like you mentioned, which leads me to the question, like, how can we make research more accessible?
So I think you touched on a few different things there. So there's different stages in the research process that can impact how accessible it is. You talked a little bit about the design of the research. Matt has also mentioned a little bit about once the research is out there, how can we make those results accessible? Mm-hmm. So there are a few different ways to approach this question. As Matt said, sort of community engaged research is about starting with community and working with community to hear what their priorities are, to be able to have that conversation and collaboration and make sure that the research questions you're asking actually respond to their needs or can sometimes validate, because while community engaged research and CLEAR can work from a place where all perspectives are valued, one of the perspectives that we have heard is that there are structures in this world that will listen to a peer-reviewed paper to support their own advocacy work. And that's also one of the reasons to bring some of these researchers together. But you want to make sure that that research is actually responding to their needs and is not replicating something that's already happened. So to make it more accessible, you can start by listening and valuing what is out there and what's coming from the people most impacted. And then once you publish, think about how you're communicating those results. So you mentioned jargon. You want to think about not even just jargon, but different ways that people are framing problems and talking about different issues might change across different communities. You also want to think about language. So one thing, when we're especially talking about the Downtown East Side, there are also a number of recent immigrants. It's also, you know, right beside Chinatown. There are a number of different languages spoken in and around the Downtown East Side. So you want to think also about which languages you are sharing your research results in. Mm. And I'll pass this last bit to Matt, because this is a key initiative of the Learning Exchange about the Making Research Accessible initiative, which is, once this work is already published, how are you making it available and evergreen and accessible through language to wider communities.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll talk about the MRAI, Making Research Accessible Initiative. I'll end with a climate angle on this, though. I'll promise I'll get there. I'm going to start with research more broadly. The MRAI has existed for quite some time, I think a decade now, and it really did identify that there was a lot of research that had been done in and with community. A lot of it had been done, you know, very well, but when it came to publication, dissemination, and sharing it back with the community who participated in it, you know, it was either like it has been published in an academic journal and is behind a paywall. We are going to go, you know, present it at this conference in Berlin. No community will be there. Yeah. When it came to sharing the information back, it was just kind of like, I published, it's there if you need it. But there was not a lot of consideration about how are we meaningfully giving this back to the community. That was kind of the origin of the MRAI, a few different ways that we really address making research accessible. And this is kind of the MRAI itself. We support community-based research. If there's a community group who's looking to do research, we can connect them with faculty or resources. If there's a faculty member or a student who wants to do research in and with the communities, we're happy to consult with them to kind of talk about what that looks like. One of the main outputs we have is called the Downtown Eastside Research Access Portal. This is developed in collaboration with the UBC Library and some really wonderful folks at the UBC iSchool, which trains all of the wonderful librarians who come out of UBC. It's an online repository. It looks quite similar to the UBC Library or the Circle platform, which we have. That's an online free repository where a lot of students upload their theses, or it's open access publication. So we work really closely with the Circle team. We reach out to researchers who have published articles specifically about the Downtown Eastside communities working in and with them that are hidden behind paywalls, and we say, hey, congrats on your publication. Very exciting. Nothing we can do about the copywritten version that is currently on said academic journal, but the manuscript before it went to formal publication, the version that before it went to the journal, that we can actually apply for a Creative Commons license for that. We can upload that to Circle, and we can therefore put that for free on the Research Access Portal. And so, yeah, we have a team of student librarians who are working at UBC, reaching out to researchers. Almost all of them say, yes, please put my research for free on the Research Access Portal. And that was kind of the early days of the MRAI. It was just kind of taking things that had cost money before, making them free. Just because research is free does not mean it's accessible. I think Michelle identified some other things that make research inaccessible around jargon. And so we started working with first-year undergraduate students at UBC, something that I wish I had done when I did my undergraduate studies back in Alberta. These first-year undergraduates work directly with one article and one researcher from the Research Access Portal that has been made open access. They get feedback directly from the author, and they develop plain language summaries that de-jargonize the article and make it kind of layman's terms. If somebody doesn't speak English as a first language or just doesn't speak academic, they're able to digest the main contents, the main findings of that article. Not accessible enough, we take it another step further. After the plain language summary is done, the students start working on some kind of interpretation of the data. Primarily, that has been infographics. The students have created infographic visualizations, really simple, nice-looking infographics that we put on the Research Access Portal next to the articles. And so if somebody wants to really quickly digest the contents, they just take a look at the infographic. If you're an individual community member who wants to learn more, you can access it that way. If you're an organization who's writing a report that involves the topic that you're writing about, hey, there's all the stats and data you need all in one place. It was really embedding levels of accessibility. Those outputs have looked like other things now. We have interpretive websites, videos that are adding on to just the infographics. It's been a really cool ongoing collaboration. It's called the UBC Share Program. Project Students Harnessing Academic Research for Exchange. I'm happy I remember the acronym. Yes. But that is first year undergrads really learning what does accessible research look like, learning about community engaged issues. It's a really, really cool project. And so, bringing this back to our wonderful friends at SFU, when they published this climate roadmap that I mentioned earlier, one of the main recommendations, one of the tangible actions was, ideally, the city, the province, health authorities, these folks who are putting out really important, good information about how to stay cool, where cooling centers are, it's really great that it's out there, but a lot of it, again, is not tailored or curated to the needs of the Downtown Eastside community. I mentioned the one that said, go, you know, shopping and cool yourself down that way. And so we worked with some folks at Hogan's Alley. We worked with the SFU team, and we worked with this idea of the power of infographics and accessible information. We brought some existing infographics that were made by the City of Vancouver, Fraser Health, Coastal Health. There were some by the government of BC, and we brought them to the residents of Nora Hendricks Place. That's a supportive housing site very close to the Learning Exchange that's maintained by the amazing folks at Hogan's Alley. We spoke with 20 different residents. It's a modular housing unit, temporary housing, but they're really amazing at what they do. A lot of the residents don't have air conditioning, though, and so they kind of met some of the criteria for not having access to mechanical cooling. And so we brought some infographics that, you know, recommended using AC or what to do when it gets smoky. How do you create a clean air room? But not all the information was super applicable to the Downtown Eastside context. And we said, what information on the, we had two infographics on each topic: indoor wildfire smoke, outdoor staying cool, or identifying signs of heat stroke. And we said, what information is actually meaningful to you? What applies to your lived experience? What has nothing to do with you? This is not helpful information. And we worked with an amazing team of students who interviewed folks in Nora Hendricks Place, synthesized the feedback, took those existing infographics, and kind of created a new one that was really specific to the needs of folks who living in SROs or modular housing, don't have access to AC. They may be dealing with, especially these past few weeks, wildfire smoke coming indoors. They may not be able to do a super great job getting airflow through their units. How can we create informational materials that are specific to the needs of Nora Hendricks Place or other housing situations in the Downtown Eastside? And so the students all created infographics really aligning with the recommendations from the climate roadmap, saying here's accessible climate information that is it cuts out all the noise, all the jargon, and all the things that don't apply to your context. Here's information that will help you stay safe. It's in, you know, plain language terms. And the nice thing is we really only started intending it to be for Nora Hendricks Place, but it's now gone to all different organizations through the community. Folks heard about it and they said, we want these infographics as well. So I've been hand delivering it to different organizations around the Downtown Eastside, making sure that the information gets out there. But that's, again, it was kind of saying, like, you know, a lot of assumptions have been made by the people who created these infographics. Are they really trying to create a really diverse tool that would meet a lot of folks' needs? How can we hear directly from community members who have that lived experience, who know what strategies they use to stay cool, what information is actually meaningful to them, and let's make something that is by the Downtown Eastside, really for the residents here, with a little bit of student power facilitating that work, but recognizing that those folks have the knowledge of what they can do to stay cool in their context. How can we share that knowledge out and not just academic infographics or publications?
Yeah, that's actually awesome. I love the word de-jargonize, first of all. It's very good.
It's harder than it sounds like. When you think you've de-jargonized something, it's like simpler. A lot of the work that the students do is just like even simpler than that. Like keep going, keep trimming out. It's a tricky exercise to de-jargonize something. It sounds quite simple. It sounds like you're taking all the big words out. It's a lot more than that. And it's a great learning. I learned from watching the students engage with the process.
Yeah, totally. And that's just a step in applying it too. So I know there's always like this, not always, but there's often sometimes like a disconnect between theory and then actually applying that to real life and having it be super effective. So yeah, we've talked about theory, we've talked about some applied things. I was wondering more, like, it's more of a thematic question, but I was wondering, what does the term climate equity mean to you both? And building upon that a little bit, just in your name, Clear, I'm curious how the resilience piece ties in.
So climate equity speaks to a number of different issues. So it's not only who is impacted the most from different climate impacts or impacts from climate change, or is it only who is contributing most to climate change? It's more of this piece that Matt has also been talking about, is who also has the skills and who is empowered to have the capacity to respond to those climate change impacts. And I think that's what CLEAR has really been trying to do, address really those, that last piece and that first piece. So identifying, like, working with the people most impacted by some climate change impacts, including extreme heat and other extreme weather, and how can we empower and provide tools or other resources so that they can mobilize and use the strategies that they already know what to do, and then also teach them some new tricks along the way. So the resilience is a little bit of that. So when people already know how to respond, and already some of the things that CLEAR did, so those pop-up cooling and heating stations, those came from community. Mm-hmm. That idea came from community, and they said, we need to share these supplies. And they were already doing those things and taking those actions and visiting and checking in on their neighbors, bringing in ice, bringing in water during the heat dome in 2021. CLEAR just came in and said, okay, what would you like to do? What are you already doing? What do you need to be able to do that? And some of that was funding for more resources and more supplies. And so that's also what we've been able to do this year with collaboration with the SFU roadmap. And that resilience piece is about, okay, long term, how do we do this? We've been starting with these immediate actions of handing out materials, but that doesn't actually change. That doesn't bring cooling into their buildings. It doesn't give them housing to have access to cool buildings. It doesn't make them feel welcome in spaces to go window shopping. Mm. And so that resilience piece is that some of those building conversations and building relationships with decision makers, and that is also a long-term action plan. Those also take time to build in those relationships, policy changes, as we mentioned, and we, you know, highlighted that about shade structures. They take time, but that doesn't mean that you can stop taking steps in those directions. You can't lose sight of that vision of, okay, we eventually need to be able to put up a shade structure. We need to keep working on this, of making this easier. And also, what do we do immediately? So that resilience piece is that long-term vision, as well as the immediate responses.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you did a wonderful job of just kind of, like, the resilience is already there. Folks already have really wonderful strategies. Sometimes it feels like the resilience for me, what I'm kind of witnessing is, like, again, like, a lot of these organizations very much are organizations who are working with peers, with residents, with individuals. All of them are very attuned to this and have their own strategies of dealing with it. I think part of it is, number one, their concerns being taken seriously, whether that's by politicians, by academics, by anybody, just making sure that it's understood that, like, yes, we are resilient, but we are also on the front lines of this and are suffering the effects in a disproportionate way. And, like, that really needs to be recognized in the way that information is communicated and the way that resources are distributed. That comes down to the equity piece. I think also, like, again, recognizing that so many organizations, I really talked about how a lot of the CLEAR partners don't necessarily consider themselves sustainability organizations, but they're doing it because they recognize how important it is to the community, to the folks that they're working with, since they're doing it off of kind of the side of their desk, or they're now allocating budget that they may not necessarily have to making sure that they have the supply. That's where I'm least seeing the resilience come through, is that so many organizations and individuals are embedding this into their day-to-day practice, their budgets, their year, like, but they don't have the capacity and resources to necessarily do so, but they're still doing it because they have to, because it's necessary, because it's really that we're seeing the impacts right in front of us, you know. And I think, like, it's taking a lot out of understaffed, under-resourced organizations to do this work, and that's where the resilience is coming through, is that they can't be like the Learning Exchange used to be and say, no, not in our scope anymore. They have to be resilient because it's directly impacting everyone that they work with, and, you know, I think that's been really resonant in the work with CLEAR, is witnessing these organizations really go above and beyond, put in hours, put in, you know, developing these peer networks to really address this when it isn't necessarily in the bigger scope of their work, but it's they're very solutions oriented, and this is what needs to be done. And so they're looking for support, networks, organization. That's where we can kind of jump in. But yeah, the resilience is already there, and it just has to be. Climate change needs to be taken seriously. First and foremost.
Yes. Yeah.
I will add to that resource piece, and taking climate change seriously, mm-hmm. is one thing that we've heard again and again from community partners. When they are responding to these climate change impacts, responding to extreme weather, they are purchasing supplies because mm. they are needed. And you mentioned that there's not necessarily budget for it. So that is something that is really important, and that is a long-term vision. And really, it shouldn't be long-term. It should be able to be, you know, addressed fairly immediately when we are in a state of emergency because of some impacts from climate change impacts with the wildfires across BC. Climate change is an emergency that you need to be prepared for, just like these organizations are mandated to have earthquake mm-hmm. prepare kits. Mm-hmm. They should be mandated and have budgetary support to be able to respond to climate change impacts. And so that means that they should be able to have a budget line when they are applying for funding, when they are receiving funding from public organizations, to be able to build in these costs that they are already taking on and that they have to take on. even cities that are responding to extreme climate impacts cannot pre-order supplies until there is a state of emergency or a heat wave that has been declared, because that is the way the funding structure works. Yeah. And so how can we adapt these larger structures to actually be able to be prepared and mobilize some and take advantage of some lower costs of buying some of these materials, things like water and fans that you need to have in advance to have the resiliency to mitigate, you know, using all these big fancy climate words, to actually be able to respond to the climate change and, you know, not die in a heat wave.
Yeah, no, that was an aha moment for me. I think it was a community member at one of our forums who said just what you said, was like, the city of Vancouver, UBC, all these organizations have earthquake preparedness kits. You have stockpiles of supplies if and when — we have not had one in our lifetime that has devastated the community, and knock on wood, hopefully we don't have one in our lifetime — but we're hyper prepared for, well, maybe not hyper, we are prepared for the eventuality of, if an earthquake happens, we have water, we have food, we have like shelter, we have all these supplies ready. When it comes to climate change, we're actually defunding or taking away funding from something that we are directly seeing the impacts of on a day-to-day basis every summer now. We don't have earthquakes every day in the summer. We sure are having a lot of 30 degree days though. And so the idea that we do have earthquake kits for something that may or may not ever happen, but we don't have the funding for climate kits for something that we're directly seeing the impacts of, like when somebody said that, I was like, I had never thought of it that way. And that is bang on how we're applying these resources, what we're putting that funding to. Why would we not put the same attention to something that is actually impacting us day to day now? I had never thought of it that way. And I can't remember who it was that said it, but I was like, bang on. Like, how have I never considered it like that? But it's true. Like, what are the priorities? Why are we moving funding away from climate supplies? It seems baffling. I'm sure the community is baffled. We're all baffled by it, right? Yeah.
Totally. Thank you for bringing that comparison up. I've never thought about it that way either. And that is quite pertinent, because like, it is so frustrating that these things are not being addressed right now and also prevented, because like, we can still do things to help. Yeah. Like you said, like mitigate this issue. And we are coming to the top of the hour right now, so I just wanted to ask one final question. If you can just sum it up in a minute or two, a few minutes. Like, what are some current projects that y'all want to highlight at CLEAR, or future projects?
So Matt did raise a few of the projects that the CLEAR has been working on. The infographics is a big one. Mm-hmm. This joint procurement, so being able to buy these supplies together with a number of different organizations, that has been a big focus of this summer in particular, to be able to respond immediately to extreme heat. And we are working with CLEAR partners to continue to have those long-term conversations, because we really want to find, for example, a solution to having immediate shade, to increasing green spaces and access to cooling spaces outside for those folks who also can't access cooling inside their buildings, or maybe not have a building. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things and the conversations that we've been having.
Yeah, the summer's really been looking at the procurement, like filling the gap that was created by the defunding of the cooling kits. So a lot of our efforts have gone towards that. Not a lot of room for other things right now. When the fall wraps up, we're going to kind of take a look at the roadmap. We've identified, we did a little bit of the communications piece, we did some of the procurement piece. There's a lot of other ideas in there that we want to kind of, we're doing some, I think, some visioning with some community partners in September, saying what else can we do now that the heat has started. Hopefully by September it's alleviating, maybe not this year. What else can we do? I do think the shade structure one is a big one that we will need quite a few minds on, both academic, community. We need some engineers to consult with maybe. But I think a big focus is going to be looking at that roadmap and saying what other tangible solutions exist in here. And I think there's always the wonderful thing is, as folks learn about CLEAR, whether they're students, researchers, community, they're like, how can I get involved with this? I want to contribute to this, because I see the value of really connecting all these resources together. And so I think staying open to opportunities, sometimes just the right person pops up. I think when we got connected to Liv Yoon, it was like, oh my gosh, this is some really amazing research that I think if we find ways to really share this out with community, there are a lot of people be on board with this. And so identifying those emerging researchers who are contributing to the dearth of climate research as it relates to the downtown Eastside communities, finding ways to connect them with on the ground movements, staying open to possibility. I will also mention
I do need to interject. We have 50 seconds left.
Municipal election, so we're waiting to see what happens with that. So stay tuned, because that could change things a lot.
Don't lose sight of communities.
Yeah. Totally.
Exactly.
Thank you, Matt and Michelle, so much for joining me on this episode of Super Summer Programming. This is CJSF 9.1 FM. Up next is Typically Tuesday, so stay tuned for that. And yeah, I'll be here on Friday as well for another episode. So see you then. Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to our Super Summer Programming.
Catch us next Friday from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m.
And until then, stay super chill.